Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with William English. That's me. And today's guest live in the studio is Felicity Sparrow. Good afternoon, Felicity.
Hi.
Felicity was the longtime partner of artist Ian Brakewell, whose work is presently on show in Derby, but also...
At the Derby Quad.
The Derby Quad. Okay. And can you tell me a bit more about the gallery? What sort of gallery is it? I've never been to it.
Well, it's relatively new. I think it was opened about 18 months ago. And it has two cinemas, a media tech, and an exhibition space.
Right.
From the outset, they've been very keen to show Ian's work as one of the few local artists.
He was born in Derby, wasn't he?
He was born in Derby. He grew up in Long Eaton, and he went to Derby College of Art, and in fact had his first ever exhibition in Derby.
I just happened to have the... in fact, 2 weeks ago, I did a sort of show and discussed this, and that is actually the catalogue of the show, which you've already seen. And, I mean, he was born, 1943?
Mm-hmm.
This catalogue, it doesn't give a date, and I couldn't pin it down.
I think it was 1964.
Right.
Which would have been when he left, was leaving Derby College of Art, because it was a joint exhibition with Kevin Coyne.
Yes. Yeah.
And his mum was talking about it, actually, when...
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
She's still alive, and she came to the opening of Ian's show.
Yeah.
And we were photographed. I think... I mean, it celebrates a number of firsts. You know, it's the first major show since Ian's death, and it's certainly the first show in Derby.
Yeah.
His first major show was probably in 1977 in the Midland Group in Nottingham, and he's since then exhibited widely and internationally. I think the exhibition is certainly interesting, and it's a relatively small space, or rather Ian was a very prolific artist, but I think it's a very good introduction to his work because it spans some of his earliest pieces. One which is an etching, I think, called Regent Snooker Hall Derby, which in fact Ian gave to me just after our first holiday in Ireland when he taught me to play pool.
Right.
And in fact he's written about... watching the film The Hustler, which celebrates pool playing, amongst other things, whereas Ian was only familiar with snooker back then, but enjoyed, as if one can see if one reads Derby Days, he celebrates the character of Minnesota Fats, who defeats the Paul Newman character, Fast Eddie, and everyone... In recreating the game, no one wanted to be the Flash Paul Newman. Everyone wanted to be Minnesota Fats, which in Ian's case did require a stretch of the imagination because he was extremely thin.
Right.
Anyway, The Hustler as a film is in fact included in a film program that is showing in March alongside the exhibition.
Hmm.
The exhibition, it includes a number of key works, including The Walking Man Diary, which is on loan to Quad from the Tate Collection. It was and remains a key work of the 70s in terms of Ian's output, and illustrates his use of the diary as a medium for both his thoughts and his observations about the world around him. In the case of the walking man, it's a figure that he observed walking around the Smithfield area where he lived at the time. He never met him, he never knew him, but he imagined, and he knew he wasn't a tramp because he didn't carry any bags, and he always walked very purposefully. And Ian took to photographing him from his third floor window whenever he saw him, and began to imagine what the walking man might have passed in his perambulations and what he thought, what he might have passed. So alongside The Walking Man, there's other early-ish works like Estate. And it ranges up to more recent work, a series of pen and ink drawings, which he called Valserings, which are based on the writer, or rather what Ian imagined the writer Robert Walser might have, that's W-A-L-S-E-R, perhaps not pronouncing it right.
Sounds all right. I'm not familiar with him at all. I've never heard of him, actually.
Well, he was a big influence on Kafka, and of course Kafka had also been an influence on Ian.
Right.
Including Kafka's diary, which was published posthumously. No, Ian had never heard of him. In fact, the people working at compendium bookshops at the time, they were very canny booksellers.
Yeah.
And Ian went in one day and they brought a copy out from under the desk saying, "We thought you might be interested in this." So, of course, Ian bought it and became fascinated. And
He started with his diary almost straight after art school, didn't he, or not?
Yes. Yeah. I think the earliest... 60s, yes.
Yeah.
But they started out... I think the first ever diary, which in fact Ian destroyed, although there's a few images from it on... taken from photographs on his website, which I can give you the details of at the end. And that was purely a drawn diary. And then it became text and image. It was never a first-person diary. Much more, well, as Ian said, it recorded the side events of everyday life. But it... evolved as the years went by. And I would guess by the 80s, he had more or less ceased to make a visual or visual-verbal diary, say like The Walking Man. And he then started far more just writing. I mean, there was a Pluto Press book that was published in 1986, I think, called Ian Brakewell's Diary. And that is just written diary. And he continued keeping a diary, sometimes one-liners, sometimes several pages, right up until the month before he died.
So he has a sort of... It's quite unusual, I suppose, to be quite so literary for someone coming... I mean, did he have any... He didn't study writing formally as such. Did he just develop his own... writing from reading, basically, probably.
Yes, I think.
Right.
He called himself an artist, but also a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, his theory was that if you're articulate in one medium, you're likely to be articulate in another. And,
That's all right. And I kind of, what about this one? There's The Artist's Dream.
That's fiction.
Stories and Pictures by Ian Brakewell.
Yeah.
And that's subtitled Franz Kafka Meets Ronald Furbank in Bexhill-on-Sea.
That's not his subtitle, that's some critic's subtitle.
Right.
I mean, it's a quote that they put on the front.
I see, that's nothing to do with him.
He did like Ronald Furbank.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So this was published in 1988, I think.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember I went to this reading because he's signed this for me and Sandra. It says, "Best wishes, Sandra."
Yeah.
And that was at the... Battersea Arts Centre, I think.
Was it?
In about 1988 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he gave us a reading on stage.
I can just about remember it.
Right.
Wasn't there someone else there? Was it Atlas Press? No.
I don't remember that. But, I mean, in this it says, among the author's loves are Goya, Kafka and Ronald Furbank. And to say that his fiction's combined elements of all three alerts the reader to the varied pleasures that lie ahead.
That's quite good.
Yeah.
Well, he hadn't discovered Walser by then.
Oh, right. Okay.
But he was Swiss as well. And he wrote in this strange kind of, shorthand isn't quite the word, a secret script, which... Ian has incorporated it into his imagined portraits of Walser, and has included as captions under each of the pictures phrases that Walser used. Mm. It's very striking. And of course, I can remember, these also are on the Diary Reinvented website. Because although they're not in themselves diaries, he worked on them like a diary.
Yeah.
And halfway through, I can remember it because we were living in Stoke Newington, then halfway through doing these imagined portraits, he shaved off his beard. And I said, hey, they're self-portraits. Because suddenly there he was, as Walser, which right. he hadn't realised. But Walser, he entered an insane asylum and ceased writing because he said, I'm here to be mad, not to write. And
So when did you first... Tell me about when you first met Ian.
Oh, gosh, I was working at the Arts Council. It was early 1970s. I think Ian had just made a film called Repertory, although I didn't see it until several years later. I mean,
it's not the one with the audience in it, is that the one?
No, it's the one of the camera panning round a derelict theatre,
and
the voiceover narrates what might be on stage inside.
Right. So you already? I mean, you were your own background is what, film and art?
Film.
No, film. Okay.
So I was working in the film office of the Arts Council, and I met him, I think, my first day. And I thought he looked very odd. He had very long hair and looked like Rasputin.
Yeah.
And then later on, they had a canteen upstairs, and I went with him and Rodney for lunch, and we just got chatting about...
Is that Rodney Wilson?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This, that, and the other. And I thought, he's a really nice guy. Mm. Thought no more of it. We bumped into each other several times over the years and then got together in 1975. But the first meeting was before that.
Right, right. And so, tell me a bit about were you interested in experimental film, avant-garde film, or was it just film generally?
Oh, I think film generally. I mean, I was of an age where I grew up and I went to the cinema at least twice a week.
Right.
But I encountered avant-garde film for the first time through working at the Arts Council. Mm. What's now called artists' films, and in fact it was the artists' films subcommittee.
Yeah.
As in addition to documentaries about artists, which was the two strands that the Arts Council film office did.
Yeah, yeah.
And despite a hiccupy start, I found myself quite fascinated, and when I left the Arts Council in early 1976, in fact, it was indirectly through Ian, because Ian had been a member of the co-op since it first started.
This is the London Filmmakers Co-op.
London Filmmakers Co-op. Mm-hmm. Had been there when it at Better Books, when Ron Geeson, a later collaborator with Ian, was doing the projection, and he had films in the co-op, and the film co-op, if you have a film in distribution with them, you're automatically a member, and so you're told about meetings, and which you can attend if you want to, which Ian didn't, as it happened. But he must have got information about a forthcoming meeting in which they were advertising for a distribution organiser. And he said, why don't you apply for that? And so I did, went along to the film co-op. There was Malcolm LeGrice, Peter Goodell, Simon Hartog. And the only thing I can remember them asking me was I a friend of the existing distribution organiser, who was Mary Pat Lees.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Who I'd never encountered until that moment. And I think Malcolm asked her if I was a friend of hers, and she said, no, absolutely not. And then she kind of looked terribly embarrassed and said, but she might be one day. So Equal Ops was not exactly...
So why were they so concerned about whether you were known by Mary Pat Lees?
Who knows?
Right. It was just they thought it, they didn't want it to be like an inside sort of something or other.
Nepotism.
Yeah, anti-nepotism.
But I mean, Equal Ops was hardly on the agenda in those days, right. And I can't remember what else they asked me. Hmm. Also, I mean, no one was particular. There was no other person coming up for the job. No one was particularly keen. Hmm. To do distribution. I mean, unlike now when it's has more kudos than it did then. And that was my introduction, really, to the London Filmmakers Co-op. That was in the summer of 1976, and the right. Co-op had just celebrated its 10th anniversary.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Because it was founded in 1966.
Yeah.
And the person I took over from was someone called Dieke Duzenberg. He was the one who taught me to handle film and how to take bookings and all the kind of nuts and bolts of film distribution.
Yeah. I think you were there about 4 years or so, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think you did you form Circles after that?
Yes, yes, I did, which I ran until 1985.
Right. And that was a kind of a breakaway, in a way, from the co-op situation.
Well, it was a feminist distribution, and although it took some of the elements of what the film co-op was, including that kind of membership thing, it was a women-only distribution.
Mm. And, okay. Well, to get back to the exhibition in Derby... of Ian Breakwell, the first major retrospective of Ian Breakwell.
It's not a retrospective.
It is not,
Well, Ian was a very prolific artist, and you need a far bigger space than Derby Quad to do a retrospective.
Uh-huh.
What I would say is it's a very good introduction to his work.
Right.
You know, from that first, well, not the first, but an early piece of 1960s, the Regent's Snooker Hall Derby, right up until... And it includes the valse rings that I was talking about and a series of drawings he made in 2000, which he called the Diagnosis Drawings, which he made when he'd had his final diagnosis and he knew he had cancer. And as he says himself, in a feverish anxiety, he couldn't sleep, and in the small hours of the morning, he did a drawing each day for 13 days, and then his normal sleep pattern returned.
Right.
But they're quite a powerful set of drawings, so they're there.
Right, right.
2005, and also the very final piece that Ian worked on, which is called BCAD. That's its title. In square brackets, it's Before Cancer, After Diagnosis.
Mm.
And it's actually Ian's final diary.
Right.
From...
That was quite interesting, because that actually brings me on to... Because of BCAD is, what is it, Before Christ and Anno Domini. Mm. But his first exhibition was in a church. He also did some fellowship, didn't he, in Durham Cathedral.
No, it wasn't a fellowship. It was artist in residence.
Artist in residence at Durham Cathedral. Yeah. And some of Kevin Coyne's poems often refer to Jesus and so on. Was Ian religious at all? Or?
Absolutely not.
Really? Okay.
And he didn't have any kind of religious funeral. It was completely secular.
Right.
With music that he had chosen himself.
Right.
And two speakers who... Because
the exhibition at Durham, even
when we got there on the day of the funeral, I mean, the funeral director said, "Do you want the cross taken down?" I said, "Yes, please."
Right. Okay.
It was mainly jazz that was played.
Yeah.
And the piece where it was a cremation, and very powerful final choice of music was Welcome. By John Coltrane, he was a fairly spiritual composer.
Mm. So the exhibition at Durham, I think that he did was called Deep Faith, wasn't it?
No,
no,
no. That was something he did slightly later. I can't remember the title of the exhibition at Durham, but it was one of his, it wasn't the first, but I think it was his second. He had prior to that done a number of what he called audience studies, and in which was faces that he had witnessed but recreated in his studio. And it was the same in Durham. That's right, it was called the Phantom Matinee. A lot of, at this time, instead of an audience, it's the congregation, because he had free rein to go around Durham Cathedral. And he was intrigued how it became a kind of spiritual centre for the community, and how people would often sit there, sometimes in complete silence, sometimes praying, sometimes doing nothing. And he did a series of paintings of solitary figures. Deep faith was something that came a lot later, but it did use music that the organist had, that Ian had asked to record him playing Messiaen. And Deep Faith is just an, it's an installation of, I think, about 75 minutes. But the image is of a woman, it's an x-ray of a woman who swallowed a crucifix.
Right.
And the piece is that long. I mean, it's actually just dissolves from one image to another. The words Deep Faith and this crucifix, x-ray of a crucifix in a woman's throat.
Right.
And it's that long simply because that's the length of the music.
Right, right.
And it was first shown, I think, in the 291 Gallery, which was an previously been a church in Hackney Road, 291 Hackney Road. But it's not something that he had done while he was at Durham.
Right. So what about the title of the exhibition, which is The Elusive State of Happiness? Do you think that was that his choice of words? Or?
No. Well, it's based on a picture that he did at about, I think, 1980, in which he's used headlines from a local newspaper, the Long Eaton Advertiser. A lot of them are kind of got question marks, like, is a man pushing a bicycle a pedestrian? And anyway, in the middle of all these torn-up headlines, which form the majority of the image, there's a discarded photograph that Ian found in one of those photo-me booths of on Long Eaton Station, of a man in a flat cap who is too short for his face to be totally visible. So you see kind of half of him, and he's looking a bit pissed off because he's obviously not in the right position, and presumably that's why he rejected the photo. But one of the captions is The Elusive State of Happiness,
right,
which is there, not one of the bigger ones, but it's a smaller headline. And if you like, it's a kind of sister piece to The News, which was a video that Ian made in 1980 in which he parodies the news by kind of inverting the values of broadcast news, which is about national events, and Ian's news is about very trivial, very local events, and very funny as it happens.
Well, we should say this, the exhibition runs, doesn't it, from the 13th of February to the 18th of April 2010 in Derby.
And there's a film season that runs through March. I don't have the dates to hand.
Right.
Of Ian's favourite films, including The Hustler, L'Atalante.
Oh, right.
And two programmes of short films, including one programme is called Seeing in the Dark, which is about experiences of cinema going depicted on screen.
And the exhibition is it is ostensibly curated by the Anthony Reynolds Gallery and yourself, Felicity Sparrow.
And the two members of staff from Quad. It was a four-way curatorial.
Yes.
Thing.
Although we've already had a kind of a slight discussion about the word curator.
I just wanted to end by telling people about BCAD, because it was Ian's last diary.
Right.
And when I, and it's the first time it's been shown in this country. It's been shown, it was shown in 2008 in the, as an installation at the Cork Film Festival. And it also showed in New York. When I introduced the exhibition at the time, I said to people, it's an installation because it's quite intense and you may not feel you want to sit through all of it because it lasts about an hour. And it's Ian reading his final diary. It's still full of humour and wry observations, but he's also chronicling his body's deterioration and his anticipating his own death. So it's moving. I mean, I know it's a very powerful piece because of the number of people who came up and talked to me about it and thanked me for it in Cork. But I said at the time that perhaps on the day of the opening was not the time to actually sit and look at it, that it was a day of socialising rather than sitting and contemplating death.
Right.
But it is very powerful.
It lasts an hour?
Just under an hour.
What is it? What form does it take? What is it?
It's a digital video and it's images of Ian from a baby right up until the month before he died. Still images that morph into each other. So it's a constant, although it's still, it's a constantly moving, morphing image, which I have to say was done very well by Alex Fry, who is himself a video editor, and this was a labour of love. And Connor Kelly, who's himself a sound artist, recorded Ian reading from his final diary for BCAD.
Right.
Hopefully one day the whole thing will be published. If we have time, it would be really good to play a short extract from BCAD, which is I've called, Ian didn't call it this. It's dated, it's a diary entry for September 2004. And it's just after he's had the results, the first results of the biopsy, where they think the cause of his lung cancer might have been smoking.
Right.
And he decides to think about and discuss all the cigarettes he had ever smoked in his life. And it's a very humorous piece, including a description of the elaborate packs they were in. And it ends by him talking about going to the pub at night for the one cigarette he allowed himself of the day. Because his mother had always inculcated in him from youth never to give up. Not, obviously, she wasn't talking about smoking, but Ian decided to apply that to smoking. So he had his one a day, and he describes what that one a day was like. And he said it was worth more than 100 thoughtlessly smoked cigarettes. That is how to not give up.
Okay, I think on that note, we should end today's programme. I could probably try and play that track on another occasion, perhaps next week, but we don't have it available at the moment. Okay. So, well, thank you very much to Felicity Sparrow for coming in and talking about Ian Breakwell, the exhibition, The Elusive State of Happiness, at the Quad Gallery, Derby, until the 18th of April.
Do you want the web details?
If you know them off the top of your head.
I do. The website is antonyreynolds.com/breakwell/diary. Okay. And it gets you into the website, The Diary Reinvented.
Great. All right. Thanks very much, Felicity. Thank you.